good to see you tonight. Just plowing through the Bible. You know, it's great. We're starting a new book tonight. And so let me just take this time, since we're all kind of just moseying in still and stuff. There's still a few seats up in the front here. If you want to mosey on up, now's a good time. Don't be bashful. If you have a few seats, there's one over here, one right there. There's just a few seats kind of sprinkled here. But also, don't forget, I'll just give you a few hints, things that have helped me over the years as a kid growing up in a church that went through the Bible, book by book, chapter by chapter, verse by verse. One of the things I found that I used to really rebel against, and that is the act of taking notes. One of the things I've found is that taking notes is helpful, whether you're one of those people like I was for years who said, I just don't remember as much when I take notes. I can think and concentrate better without having to write and stuff. And I used to know all the arguments for that. But I have found that there's something about writing something down, even if you never look at it again. It sort of leaves an impression on your mind that's greater in some ways. And yeah, taking notes is hard at first, but it's one of those things that you can do that is a skill, that's one that you can develop. And also, I'll tell you, some people disagree with me on this, but I like to write really tiny in my Bible, because I always have some of the things the Lord's showing me, some of the things the Lord's been speaking to me, kind of written down. And I'll tell you my secret, I write in pencil, because sometimes those things, the Lord kind of changes over the years. Sometimes I erase things that I wrote in the Bible and say, what was I thinking back then? And, pencil's good. And also, not only writing, taking notes, but don't make the mistake, and this is a mistake I've made, don't make the mistake of thinking because you and I are here studying our Bibles and because you've written the notes and what have you, that we've got it down. It's something about how I've been through the Bible, I've gone through those verses, I've been through that book, and so I've been there, done that, and I've got it down. But frankly, there's something in our mind that kind of says you've got it once you've been through it, written it down. But man, I like to go back over my notes years later sometimes and say, well, wow, how am I doing with some of the things I learned back in 2005 on that, you know, September evening? How far have I come? Have I gained any ground? Or am I still exactly where I was 10 years ago or whatever, if the Lord doesn't come back first? And so to have it down in your notes to be able to refer back and say, Lord, how am I doing? And just kind of a checkpoint, that's always good too. But also, Bible says, study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. And that's what we're hoping to do, is just go through the Bible, letting it change us and transform us and what have you. So, man, I'm glad you're here. Glad we're going through the Bible together. And so the new book we're starting, since we just finished up Proverbs on Sunday, let's go ahead and turn to Ecclesiastes tonight. And if you're new tonight, just take your Bible, look right in the middle and open it up, and you'll be probably in Psalms. And then go right, turn right, turn pages, you'll go to Proverbs. But at the end of Proverbs, start slowing down, because there's Ecclesiastes, and you might miss it if you turn too many pages. So Ecclesiastes is right after Proverbs chapter 31. So Ecclesiastes chapter 1. It says in verse 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. We have here a book that right at the get-go, the author identifies himself. This is none other than Solomon, David's son. Solomon, of course, that king of Jerusalem, king of Israel, who was the wisest man that ever lived on the face of the earth apart from Jesus Christ. Why? Why was Solomon so full of wisdom? Well, we know, if you were with us when we were studying back in his life, we found that he was really given one wish by the Lord. And he didn't ask for women, although he got women. He didn't ask for gold, although he got gold. He didn't ask for horses and chariots, although he got horses and chariots. Amazingly, Solomon, he said, this is the one thing I asked for. I asked for wisdom. And so the Lord gave him this humongous load of wisdom. And so Solomon was known at that time to be so wise that people came from all over the earth to hear Solomon's great wisdom. Amazing guy was Solomon. And so Solomon now, he's calling himself the preacher. In fact, this is the only time in the Old Testament the word preacher is used here in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now you say, well, what does the word Ecclesiastes mean? Well, the word Ecclesiastes is a Greek word that was given as a title to this book that means convener of an assembly, or kind of like the leader of a group, or perhaps even speaker in a congregation, or as under many of your titles, it says Ecclesiastes or the preacher. The Hebrew word for this title of this is actually more of this, the idea of a preacher. And so he's preaching to a crowd. Who's he preaching to? Well, us tonight. Solomon, this man who is full of wisdom, is preaching to us a lesson, a message that he wants us to hear. And so it's good for us to listen to this preacher, the king of Israel, son of David, and he's going to write this book for us to learn. But there's something you need to learn here before we get into the topic at hand. You see, really, this book has a single idea, a single topic. But before we get into that, you need to understand the context in which Solomon is writing this book. You see, one of the problems you're going to have with the book of Ecclesiastes and another book I'll throw in there for you, college students or what have you, you Bible students, another book you need to be kind of have your antenna up, Ecclesiastes and the book of Job, and I'll tell you why. They're two books that you might find trouble there. And I'll tell you why, because the atheists, the existentialists, the humanists, and all the people who are really kind of opposed to God and godliness, they will use the book of Job and the book of Ecclesiastes, and they'll quote scriptures from those books because they find contradiction in the Bible. And this is one of the fun ones. I love it when professors or atheists come and say, well, just look at the book of Job. Look at the book of Ecclesiastes. And they start quoting for that. I love it when they go there. I'll tell you why. Because they don't understand. They haven't read other parts of the Bible. In other words, a lot of times an atheist will hear from another atheist and say, did you hear what the book of Ecclesiastes said? And they'll quote some little scripture in Ecclesiastes and say, see, it's wrong. It's contradiction. But if you only knew the context of the book of Ecclesiastes, it makes perfect sense why Solomon was saying what he's saying. You want to know the context? This is important. You need to know this for the next couple of weeks as we're going through this book. The context is Solomon is in a backslidden state. Solomon is disconnected from God. Solomon is following after pagan, heathen gods, and he's finding no satisfaction, he's finding no happiness, and no meaning in life, because he's apart from God. That's the context. And even Solomon's going to let us know that. And so the atheist who quotes from Ecclesiastes, and I'll show you a few verses as we come to them that people go, oh, there it is, right there. I'll show you those. But all you have to do is realize, oops, Solomon's looking at everything pretty much in the whole first 12 chapters of Ecclesiastes. Brett, there's 12 chapters in Ecclesiastes. That's right. It's only the last two verses he gives us the answer. Don't turn back and look. I see you guys. You're like, well, let's come back. Hey, what's that? No, don't do that. In fact, it really, it's an amazing thing. Solomon, he's going to just go on and on and on about the vanity and meaninglessness of life. But then he's going to give us the punchline at the very, 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 very end. And so contextually, you have to be careful with Ecclesiastes. Now, why do I bring up Job as well? Well, contextually, you've got to remember Job. Many of his buddies, the three buddies or four buddies that Job talks to, the dialogues that are very long-winded, if you remember when we went through Job together, it was a very long-winded dialogue between Job and his friends. But the thing is, you can read those dialogues and they sound fancy, they sound very esoteric and academic, and there's some good things, but you have to understand there's also some very wacko, bad things that Job's friends and even Job himself say. So much so that by the time you get to the end of Job, God speaks up and says, you guys don't know anything about what you're talking about. So you have to kind of discount everything from that point backward in the book of Job as being actual factual truth. Because those guys were just speaking their own minds. And under the inspiration of God, their words were recorded in the Bible as erroneous. You follow me? You have to understand that. I hope I'm not losing you there. That's important. So, for example, I'll just give you one quick thing where verse 4 of this Ecclesiastes chapter 1. It says, one generation passeth away, another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. Oop, right there. Find a problem with the Bible, because the earth is it going to abide forever, or is it going to be destroyed? Because I happen to know in my Bible, as the atheist would say, in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, it says, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away with great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat, and the earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. So it says the earth is going to destroy, and there's going to be a new heaven, a new earth. Any, you know, Bible student would agree, yeah, the Bible does talk about how the earth will be destroyed. So here's a contradiction in the Bible, and they'll use this, but you have to understand the context. Solomon's going to say a bunch of things here that are just wrong, because he's in a backslidden, downfallen, disconnected state from God, and that's going to be the whole point of this book. Are you guys following me on that? It's really important to know that. So don't get sucked into these little discussions. You have to all really be careful when you're reading the Bible to take it in context of itself. What's the author saying? Where is he coming from? And read the whole book. Don't just read a few verses and stuff like that. It's an important thing not to do. So we have this written by Solomon. It's interesting because we just got through reading the accumulation of Solomon's wisdom there in Proverbs. All 31 chapters of Proverbs, we found great wisdom. We saw Solomon as the wise one. But in Ecclesiastes, we're going to see Solomon as the foolish one. And we'll even see how the wise can do foolish things. Just because you might be wise and have wisdom doesn't mean you always use it. You don't use your wisdom or my wisdom. We do that as Christians. Solomon's about to do that. And so we're going to see that. Also, you're going to find that you can't find meaningfulness or happiness apart from God. That's kind of the whole point. And so Solomon is discontented with life because he's disconnected from God. That's kind of the theme, I guess, of Ecclesiastes. He's discontented with life because he's disconnected from God. So the words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. Verse 2, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Do you sense a little frustration in Solomon's heart? He's saying vanity is vanity. What's the word? Well, in your newer translations, oftentimes the NIV and what have you will put the word meaningless. Meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. There's no meaning. There's no fruitfulness in life. There's nothing that really makes you happy. There's an emptiness. The idea is emptiness, emptiness. Everything is empty. Now, here's the thing. You got to remember, Solomon, in his downslidden state, he's saying stuff, even this. Is everything vanity? As Christians, biblically, we know that that is just not true. But there's a phrase that you need to know about, and it's in verse 3, and this is where we get context. It says here, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, but verse 3, what profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? Would you mark that phrase, under the sun, for the book of Proverbs will use that 29 times. 29 times in 27 verses we're going to read the phrase under the sun. Now, you got to go back to Genesis 1 to really understand the meaning of that. But the idea, just in a nutshell, is anything that's worldly or worldliness, excluding God, excluding his plan and purpose. When he uses that phrase under the sun, it's kind of like, well, maybe you've heard me refer to things that are worldly, or it's the world. Now, if you've been here at this church very long, when I say, man, you don't want to behave like the world, you're saying you don't want to behave like the globe, the earth? Is that what you're saying? No. I'm saying the world, that is anything that is against God and out of his kingdom, out of his character, out of his nature. But the world, worldliness, is mankind by himself and the earth and everything that exists in the earth apart from God. That's the idea of under the sun. And that's why Solomon's going to employ that word several times throughout this book. He's going to say, oh man, it's all vanity. Everything that's under the sun. But the idea is he's excluding God. Because there's something that's further than the sun, isn't there? It's greater than the sun. And that's God himself and his son, Jesus Christ. But you have to understand, contextually, Solomon's just saying, oh man, everything is vanity. Now, keep your finger here. I want you to flip back to a passage that's going to explain Solomon's downslidden, backslidden state. Would you turn with me to 1 Kings, keeping your finger in Ecclesiastes 1, 1 Kings chapter 10. Just go back maybe, half inch in your Bible to 1 Kings. There in 1 Kings chapter 10, we kind of see Solomon's context of his life here. I want to go back to his life as he lived, as he ruled and reigned in Israel, and you'll kind of see Solomon's condition, his mental state. In 1 Kings chapter 10, we'll start in verse 21. 1 Kings 10:21. It says, "And all King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None were of silver. It was nothing accounted of in the days of Solomon." What's that? In the days of Solomon, gold was so prolific, so much did they possess gold that silver became like rocks. It became like nothing. Now, if you're taking notes, jot this down. We're going to stay here in 1 Kings. I'm not done there yet. But in Deuteronomy chapter 17, in Deuteronomy 17, it's a very clear description. And we've talked about this in times past, studies before. But just a quick reminder, that's important to understand what's going on in Solomon's life and in his heart. Let me just read you quickly before we move on in 1 Kings. But in Deuteronomy 17, this is what the Lord says. "When you come into the land," he's talking to the children of Israel, "and you possess the land which the Lord has given you, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. Thou shalt in any wise set a king over thee, but he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people return to the land of Egypt that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord hath said unto you, ye shall henceforth return no more that way. Neither shall he multiply wives unto himself, that his heart turn not away. Neither shall he greatly multiply unto himself silver and gold." This is the law of God in Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 through 17. God says, don't multiply horses, particularly the ones from Egypt, because I don't want you going back down to Egypt. Why did the Lord not want the children of Israel to go back down to Egypt? Jump in there, anybody. It was the world. Egypt is a type, is a picture of the world and worldliness. Kind of interesting in context of what we're talking about. So don't multiply horses from Egypt. Don't multiply wives to yourself. Don't multiply silver and gold. Three things that kings of Israel were not to do. Did you hear what we just read in 1 Kings 10:21? He had so much gold that silver became like rocks. Oops, strike one. Now, go forward. 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 28. 1 Kings 10:28. "And Solomon had horses brought out of," where? Egypt. Oops. In verse 29, "And a chariot came up and went out of Egypt, 600 shekels of silver and horses for 150. Man, the guy started putting together a team of horses and chariots from Egypt. Ooh, strike two. And now we start in chapter 11, 1 Kings chapter 11. Check this out, and here's where it gets really sad. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1 says, "But King Solomon loved many strange women." And like I've said before, that's not necessarily like Star Trekkies or something. He likes these strange women, that is, strangers from other lands that were godless. And we'll see that. It says, "He loved many strange women together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonian, Hittites, of the nations concerning which the Lord said to the children of Israel, you shall not go in unto them, neither shall they come into you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. And Solomon clave to these in love. And he had 700 wives and princesses and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. For it came to pass that when Solomon was old, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom and the abomination of the Ammonites. Now, Milcom, by the way, Ashtoreth, of course, is the goddess of sensuality, sexuality. Milcom is another word, another name for a god that maybe you've heard of called Molech. Solomon was worshiping a god named Molech. You say, well, big deal, some idol. Yeah, Solomon was loser. Well, wait. More than a loser was Solomon. Because Moloch was a god that they worshipped by taking and pouring into giant, forms. They would make these idols of iron, huge statues that were supposed to be Moloch. And so Moloch was their big iron god, and they would make it such that the god's arms would be outstretched like this, holding his arms straight out. Inside the belly of Moloch was a huge furnace. They would throw, you know, fuel in there to make it so hot that the arms of Moloch would get glowing red hot. And then they would take their babies and place their little newborn babies on the arms of the incandescent, heated up arms of Moloch, and they would watch their babies sizzle. Solomon was one who practiced this worship to Moloch by sacrificing children on the idols of Moloch. Sad thing, historians tell us that the women would circle around Moloch and scream, and they would beat drums as loud as they could so they could drown out the screams of their babies so that they wouldn't have to hear them as their children died. Brutal stuff. The reason I get into that is you say, well, Brett, why are you talking about this? Okay, so he's a bad guy. Well, really, I believe there are people doing the same thing today. Worship of Moloch is alive and well. You see, they believed that by sizzling their babies on the idol of Moloch, they believed that that would bring pleasure and prosperity to them. And so, too, there are young men and women and people who are aborting their babies. So, well, it's too inconvenient to have a baby. It's not the right time. And, well, it was an accident. And so that they could be happy and go on with their lives, what do? Well, they may not be placing them on the arms of Moloch, but they're doing the same thing by aborting their babies. Sad, sad situation. And what does the world do? Covers up their ears and their eyes so that they can't hear the screams. And even though the details are quite grotesque, if you really look into what an abortion really is, it's so sad to see how we are worshiping the same God, really, by and large, that Solomon was worshiping Moloch. Pagan God, pagan deity, and it's all in the name of pleasure and prosperity. Now, notice a few phrases here in 1 Kings. It says that the women, verse 4, that he was in love with, it says in verse 4, that his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, or it wasn't right is the idea with God. He was not right with God is the idea. Verse 3, his heart was turned away by the wives that he married. Now, that's the context. You have to understand, that is the condition Solomon is coming out of as he pens Ecclesiastes. He's just coming out of that whole worshiping of idols and doing all kinds of sick, sinful things. And so now, what's he saying? He's going to tell us what he learned. Ecclesiastes is a book where he's going to say, I learned because I went against God and I was not right with God, a disconnect from God, so I was discontented with life. Nothing worked out. Nothing made me happy. I was in real despair. Why? Because I was disconnected, backslidden. Man, it's a sad thing. I wish Solomon didn't have the experience here to write this book, Ecclesiastes. But sadly, there are probably people in this room who could already, with their lives, write this book. There's many of us who we've tried to find happiness apart from God. But man, Solomon's going to give us the word here. And many of us can say, Brett, we don't even really need to read this. Oh, but yes, we do. Solomon's not going to leave any rock unturned. He's going to show that he, of all men in this world, experienced it all. Everything. He had it all. More than any man that ever lived, he had it all. And yet it was still emptiness. Meaningless vanity. So in verse 1, we see Solomon who identifies himself. Then in verse 2, we see Solomon stating his theme of the book, vanity of vanities, everything's vanity. In verse 3 through 11, we're going to see Solomon defending his theme in general terms. So now we're going to read in verses 3 through 11 the general defense of what he's about to say, that vanity is vanity, everything is vanity, and here's his general defense, verses 3 through 11. Let's look. So verse 3, what profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? Man, have you ever felt like that? What does it profit me that I get up and go to work, come home, go to bed? Get up, go to work, come home, go to bed. Get up, go to work. I mean, after a while you think, man, vanity is vanity. Have you learned that one? A lot of people who are working just under the sun, that is for no other purpose than just to be on this earth and survive. Man, it's empty. But I'll tell you, everything that he's going to call empty and meaningless and vanity, you have to understand, there is an answer to all this stuff. And I'll just kind of give you the sneak preview. That is, if you are working for the Lord, for his kingdom, to please God, then your work suddenly becomes meaningful. Well, Brett, you don't understand. You can say that because you're a pastor. You're doing things of ministry. You're talking about the Bible. That's eternal. I screw toothpaste lids on toothpaste tubes on a conveyor belt every day, all day. That's my job. Well, I believe that can be a job that is done heartily as unto the Lord if you do it for God, looking for opportunities to share and let your light shine to the other toothpaste lid screw-oners. Whatever your job is, however meaningless or vain it might seem, I believe God redeems those things should you do it as unto him. And that's where Solomon's missing, we're going to see. But that's just a sneak preview. All these verses where he's speaking of negative things, there's an answer. We'll get to that as we continue. So he's saying our labor, work becomes a waste is the idea there. Verse 4, one generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. Wow, interesting stuff. The older I get, the more I'm kind of starting to feel this thing. One generation comes and one generation goes. And it's like, poof. You know, remember when you were 6 or 7 or 8, how long a year seemed? I mean, you couldn't even really fathom a year. A year just seemed, remember how long summer used to feel? I remember getting out of school thinking, I'm really done with school for the rest of my life. In my mind, that's the way it kind of felt. Then someday, as the weather started turning cold, my mom would say, remember school? And I'm like, no. And then you get older, and the older you get, by the time I was a senior in high school, summer, oh, it went just too fast, too fast. Now, the older I get, did summer even happen? Are we in September already? It was like, poof, gone. I mean, this is an amazing thing. You know, I had the privilege of, remember the lightning and rain? We haven't had a lot of rain this last month, but we had a good rain shower just last week. I forget what day it was on. And lightning and thunder is great. Well, I was up on the church property and I got to stand there with the guy that we bought the property from, a great guy. I love this guy, Mr. Niemeyer. He's owned the property for 50 years. Sold it to the church because he listens to our radio program and likes people that go through the Bible. Bunch of other churches asked to buy his property. He said no. But this guy, you know, he's like 90 years old. And I was sitting there talking, he's telling me back when 205 was just a dirt road. He said that there would be days out on his farm that he could just be there and he wouldn't see a car for 3 days go from Wilsonville to Oregon City. 3 days. It's kind of like it is now on Friday afternoon. But when he told me, you know, I think he said he was born in 1912. Is that right? And I thought, wow. And he was talking about his dad. And he was talking about his grandfather. I was starting to do the math. This is an amazing thing. We're talking civil war here. I mean, here's a guy that I was talking to. I was just thinking, whoa. I mean, it just, you know, you have those moments where it just kind of hits you. Wow, this guy represents this much time, and he's talking about his father and his grandfather, and it goes back 150 years. That's an amazing thing to me. It just blew my mind. And we were standing there under his pole barn there that's on the church property, just listening to the rain, and we were talking about what was going on in the world, and you know, and he just was blown away watching what's going on. You know, a guy his age, he's seen a lot, but he can't believe what he's seeing coming down in the world, the way people think and the way the whole political scene has gone and what our country has done and what we're not doing and where we've moved away from godly things. And, you know, he's just an amazing guy sitting there talking to him. But from time to time, you have those moments where you just think, wow, life really is but a vapor. It's just a vapor. Poof. And the older you get, the more you feel that way. You guys all know what I'm talking about, but James, he articulates it probably as good as anybody in James chapter 4, verse 14. It says, whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanishes away. Interesting stuff. Life is just a vapor, just a little puff of mist. Poof. It's over. The brevity of life is something that a lot of us don't like to think about. It scares many people. In fact, interesting worldview that maybe some of you have studied and talked about, the philosophy of existentialism. It's kind of an interesting thing. You have to understand, they deal with the human predicament. What's the human predicament? Well, the existentialist says that life is just here and now. There's nothing before it. There's nothing after it. When you're dead, you go off into nothingness. And so this kind of philosophy started going into different people who are writers and plays, films, philosophers like Jean-Paul Sartre and Martin Heidegger, Albert Camus, Friedrich Nietzsche. Maybe you guys have heard of these guys. If you're in college, you have your profs probably talking about these guys quite a bit. But Nietzsche, he was a pre-existentialist because he kind of was before all this happened. But the basic formula is this, that you need to be strong and have courage to face the fact that your life is all there is. And you need to face that with courage, because where that kind of thinking is, if it really is, this is all what it is. If you're living for here and for now, then the notion of that is so depressing that many of the existentialists start to move to the idea of suicide. That's true as you read and study, but the true existentialist says, but you need to be brave and bold and just face it. Live your life. You know, and all kinds of thought throughout the centuries and millennia have kind of stemmed from, what is it all about? What's the meaning of life? And why are we here? Is there anything after life? And many people came up with that conclusion. Well, there's nothing after life. So many people, like the Epicureans, kind of came up with the idea, hey, pig out, live for pleasure, go for it today, because that's all there is. And so what they did is try to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. The existentialists just said, man, pig out, go to Ruth Chris every night, spend your money, drink till you're totally sloshed, just live and party and maximize. Well, the problem with that, the Epicureans found was, well, that kind of lifestyle brings pain in and of itself. You get stuffed to the point where you're sick. You have sex to the point where it's boring. You have diseases and you become just kind of glutted out with pleasure, and it becomes pain and boring and a bummer. So then there were those, the philosophers, who said, well, it's not about finding the maximum pleasure, but finding the optimum pleasure. There's a level where excess becomes pain. So they, you know, the philosophers throughout the millennia have come and gone and talked about all this stuff. But, you know, one of the sad things, Ernest Hemingway was one of those guys who had that kind of a mind view that, man, it's all about here and now. And how did he end up going? He took a shotgun and blew his brains out. Ernest Hemingway. Why? Because he had this worldview that it's really just about here and now. And he was so unhappy with here and now. He was in such financial trouble here and now. He thought, man, that's all there is, then I might as well just end it now. And that's really a sad worldview. But interestingly, that's kind of where Solomon's mind is as he's writing many of these verses. He's forgotten the things that his father taught him about the Lord. He has forgotten about God. And he's trying to ask himself, what's the meaning of life? And he forgets the bigger picture. He's only considering that which is under the sun. And man, that can be pretty depressing. If that's all you're thinking about, if that's all you're going for. And pretty soon, generation after generation just starts coming and going. You think, what's the meaning? What's the big deal? You could be even sort of famous in this world, but you know, 100 years from now, nobody's going to know who you were, even if you were semi-famous. Think of it. If the Lord didn't come back, which I think he will, but if he doesn't come back for 100 years, how many people you think will say, who was the president way back in 2005? The president of the United States? Ooh, I don't know. Why? Because, well, even some of the most famous people go off into obscurity eventually. And that can be pretty depressing because you're not the president. You're somebody who lives here in Portland. And you might have some prominence, some famous thing you've done, but is it that famous? And is it going to make you go down for centuries? Probably not. So what do you do with that? Do you just get depressed? Well, listen to what Solomon says. He says, oh man, people come and go. Generations pass away. Verse 5, the sun also ariseth. And the sun goeth down and hasteth to its place where he arose. Oh, another contradiction in the Bible, the atheist will scream. The Bible says the sun goes up and the sun goes down. We happen to know now as scientists that the earth travels around the sun, not the sun rising over the horizon as they thought millennia ago. And people get all into this and point out that the Bible's wrong and all this. By the way, when the Bible deals with science, it's 100% right. But when the Bible is using literary license, like we do today, see, if you atheists have a problem with this saying of the sun rising, then you better call the meteorologist in KATU. Because he every night on the news says the sunrise and the sunset is at, and he tells you what time is it. Ooh, he's so stupid. What an idiot. Dumb guy, doesn't even, he's a weatherman, he doesn't even know that the sun doesn't, well, see, it's a figure of speech. There's this tool we use in speech, and it's called figure of speech. And Solomon employs this tool, and it's really a no-brainer, and it just kind of cracks me up that they get all panicky over these kinds of things. Solomon's using a figure of speech that's very common in his time and still very common to this day. That's what kills me, cracks me up. So the earth, you know, this isn't a statement of science. This is a statement of philosophy. He's pontificating. He's thinking through life. And he says, man, the sun rises and the sun goes down. And he even says the sun hasteth to its place where he arose. What's the idea? Well, once the sun goes down, it seems like, bam, it's back up, ready to come up in the morning. What is he implying? He's saying, in sleep, you just don't get enough. Nighttime goes too fast. Have you found that to be true? Have you ever been so tired that your head hits the pillow and bam, it's morning. The alarm goes off. Oh, that's painful, man. Did you know the average person that lives the average length of life and all that, the average person will sleep in his lifetime or her lifetime 24 years. That's a lot of snoozing. But I do think, where does all the time go? You know, where does it all go? Well, a lot of it goes to sleep. You're sleeping. And really, I think Solomon's kind of feeling like, oh man, I'm missing out. And the time that I sleep, there's time that goes by. Have you ever found yourself staying up at late because you feel like you're missing out on something important? I don't want to go to bed because, well, it's just like, man, something might happen. Or maybe there's something on TV. So you stay up at late, watch the TV, hoping something interesting happens. And then you get up in the morning and you feel wiped out because nothing happened the night before. It's an amazing thing. And Solomon's just kind of thinking through this stuff about life and just how it's just kind of a waste. Work becomes a waste. Life becomes worthless. Time seems to fly. Verse 6, the wind goes toward the south and turns about into the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to its circuits. Man, he really must be bored now. He's sitting there watching the wind. Interesting thing about the wind and its circuits. It comes and goes and wind blows and what have you. He's going to be talking in these next several verses about the circuit of the creation. That there's these cycles. By the way, many of the pagan philosophies of ancients included the idea that everything was in a circular motion. That everything was kind of like this, where he says here that the wind moves according to his circuits and what have you. Now, in old pagan philosophy, that's what they believed, that the world was in a circuit, that everything came and went and had its time to leave and time to come back. And so they even talked about how the earth wasn't linear in time. It was more of an what now they call it a myth, but science called it oscillating universe. What's that? Well, if you would, it's kind of like saying the Big Bang, boom, things started. Then an implosion, boom, things ceased. And then boom, things started again. And many believed that it was just this oscillating universe. But you see, that really goes against what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches of a linear time, at least as it relates to this planet and earth, that there was a beginning. And that God created the heavens and the earth. And there will be an ending. And the earth will come to an end. And so, these philosophies were very pagan and worldly. The idea of this oscillating universe. Well, Solomon's kind of looked at the oscillating nature of the universe. And he sees it in the wind, but he also sees it in the water. Verse 7. All the rivers run into the sea. Yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, neither they return again. He's just kind of looking at the way it works. You know, out in the ocean there, the water, by the heat of the sun, turns into a gas vapor, and it rises up into the sky and forms clouds. And then the wind blows the clouds over the land. And then as that water vapor temperature cools, the water moves from its vapor form into droplets. And begins to fall as it's over the land, and it falls down on the mountains, and it's so cold on the atmosphere there that the water turns to snow and lands on the mountains. And then as that snow melts, goes down into the streams and flows back into the oceans. What's he seeing? He's saying that water comes up and water goes down. Water goes up, water goes down. It's just another big cycle that we watch going over and over and over and over again. The idea is he's just really bored with the monotony of everything. That's the idea. He said everything's just a cycle and it's just going over and over and over again. Verse 8, all things are full of labor. In other words, everything's work. Have you found that to be true? Everything is work. I know this to be true. You know, the fun things we do. We think it's going to be so fun. You guys that have your hobbies, you know what I'm talking about. I like, going out and riding dirt bikes with my son Joe. With some of the guys in the church, we hook up every now and then and go ride. And, you know, it's funny, you know, you think, yeah, just get a motorcycle, go ride. Well, you forget that, well, you need to change the oil, and you need to change the air filter, and you need to tighten the spokes, and you need to make sure everything's running good. And if you don't get everything running good, then it's really work, because you're out in the middle of nowhere with your motorcycle, and it's all broken down. And then you have to push it through the woods. That's work. There's not a lot of fun about that. Let's see, when was it? I went to the motocross track with Jojo, and we were there just kind of riding. It was really fun. And Joe, it was the time for the smaller bikes to ride. And so Joey was out there, and we were just kind of watching him go around. The track is 2 miles long. He was on the far side of the downside of the track, and this little kid comes running up and says, hey, your son's out of gas on the other side of the track. And so the problem was they were flagging off the little bikes, and it was ready for the big bikes to go. And, these are guys with huge motorcycles, and they're going to go really fast. And they're all waiting for Joey, who's got no gas on the other side of the track. So they're all, let us go. We want to get out there. So the lady's looking at me, and I jump on my bike, throw a gas can on the middle of the seat, and I'm riding with the gas can. I take off down there, and all the bikes are watching me like, oh, man, look at this guy. His kid's out there. So I'm out there, and I'm quickly getting the gas. And okay, we need to take off. We take off and get back. And we got back. So I said, now, Jojo, now I understand, you know, everybody makes mistakes and stuff, but, you know, you always need to check your gas before you go out. You'll make sure you have a nice full tank and stuff. And you're like, okay, Dad, you know. Well, then, it, you know, I went out there and... I was riding around with the big bikes and having a great time when all of a sudden... And it was right in front of the grandstands, you know, where everybody's watching. And so they came and brought my gas can out to me. And JoJo was gracious. He said, you know, Dad, you should always check your tank. You know, you go out to have a little fun, but it's just sometimes work. Work. There's labor in everything. Even if you're just trying to have fun, there's labor sometimes. All things, verse 8, are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. In other words, the things you want to see. Man, for some, it's, I need to see more of the United States. And so you get the little sticker on the back of your Winnebago that's got the big United States. And you start filling the little colors in, man. You've got 29 states. But man, you only, after seeing 29 states, you think the 50th is going to be the one, I have seen it all. Because after you fill the 50th state, you fill it up and you go, oh man, now I need to go do that with the world. Do they make one of those for your Winnebago? Because your eye will not be satisfied with seeing the United States. Oh, it's sure fun and that's great and all that, but your eye will never really be satisfied, nor will your ear. The things that you hear, man, I just want to hear something true. I just want to hear something new. But it'll never be satisfied. That's what Solomon's saying. Verse 9, the thing that hath been, it is that which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It hath already of old time, which was before us. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. In other words, man, there's nothing new. And if you think it's new, it's already been. All you young kids with your, you know, different fads and stuff, if you're older, you've seen them all come and go. I remember seeing back in the 70s and early 80s, the last bell bottoms go out of style. We were all thinking, oh, praise the Lord. But then several years back, you remember when we started seeing bell bottoms? And I was thinking, oh, no, not again. All those things, the styles, the fads, the fashions, they all come and go. And the young kids are like, hey, there's a new fad. And all the older guys are going, nah, been here, done that. It's an amazing thing. Solomon's nailing some truth, but it's truth without hope. That's a problem. There's nothing new. And so he kind of concludes his first just overarching argument that everything is vanity. All is vanity. And then he starts in now proving not only just the overgeneralization of vanity, but he's now going to prove his argument that everything is vanity. But he's going to use and employ his own personal experience. So far we've seen a little bit in creation and some generalizations made about his statement that everything's vain, everything's vanity. But now he's going to talk about his own experience, and he's going to talk about his own experience from this point, verse 12, all the way through chapter 2. So he's going to prove that everything's vanity from his own personal experience, verses 12 through chapter 2. Let's take a look. Verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail, or literally burdensome task, hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. There's that phrase again, under the sun. And behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. That which is wanting or defecting or defected is not able to be numbered. Verse 16, I communed with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate and have gotten more wisdom than they all, than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Oh. Now, you might be saying, Brett, this seems contradictory. Because didn't it say that the beginning of wisdom is to fear the Lord? The beginning of understanding has to do with the Lord? Solomon has lost perspective. And he's looking at things under the sun, and he's lost the fact that it's not about under the sun, it's beyond the sun, it's greater than the sun. But here he's looking in a small way, and he's saying, oh man, it just brings grief and sorrow. Listen, you'll see that as you go to college, you young teenagers and stuff. Man, check out your profs and see if they're really happy. Some of those miserable people I've seen are the most knowledgeable people I've known. Because the more you know, apart from God, man, it's just real sad. Real sad. Do you remember when you started learning stuff that was true at a certain age in your life? Started when you found out Santa Claus doesn't exist. Santa Claus was just a man. He was my dad. There's no being called Santa. And then you also found out if you change the letters around a little bit, it's Satan. Man, your knowledge. The more you know. And then it moved to other stuff. You started realizing that, man, as a little kid, you realized that marriage wasn't always forever. When your parents got divorced, you thought, man, my parents, I thought they were faultless. I thought they were without error. And then you grew up seeing your parents split up, those who were perfect. And now, oh, disappointment. Then you realize that not only were your parents not perfect, but they were sinful. Then you started realizing the sin in the world and the death and destruction of war as you learned history. And as knowledge grew, you started realizing that death and war wasn't just some movie on TV, but there's real, hideous, sick, sinful things that go on during wartime and things that are almost unimaginable and unthinkable. And maybe some of you have not even really thought through that very much. I think that a lot of Americans haven't. Because here in this war with Iraq that we find ourselves presently in, as soon as somebody dies, we realize, oh, somebody died, and that's bad. But man, our country, if we look at our history, war is not new. And death and destruction. And the freedom that we enjoy today came from people who were brave and fought and died brutal, bloody deaths. You know, the more you learn, the more knowledge you get about the world, just as it relates to the world, under the sun, man, it's depressing. And so Solomon, being the wisest man that ever walked on the face of the earth apart from Christ, don't you think he was pretty blown away how bad things really are? And he's going to talk further about his experience. He's going to say in verse 1 of chapter 2, I said in mine heart, go to now. I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity. Mirth, just laughter. I'll try to laugh and tell jokes. Now, that's something I enjoy doing. I like laughing. I like telling jokes. And I know you don't like hearing my jokes because they're not really making you laugh. But I like it when somebody makes me laugh. But here's what happens. You know, laughter is pretty fleeting. And it's hard to think of things as funny when you see things that are depressing. The world tries to do this. The world does tune in on late night with Leno or Letterman. Why? Well, because their day was depressing enough. Maybe they can end their day with a little laughter. The problem is there's crude jokes that we shouldn't be laughing at, talking about sexual things or parts of the body or making fun of people. And the Bible talks about foolish jesting and vain jesting. And we find ourselves laughing for a fleeting moment, but you go to bed after Leno and Letterman and you feel kind of empty. Have you felt that? Solomon had. Solomon had access to the comedians of the day, the jesters and what have you. And he tried to find it with laughter, but he found it to be failing. He says it's also vanity. Verse 2, I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what doeth it? Man, do you sense he's just a little depressed? Verse 3, I sought in mine heart to give myself to wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven in all the days of their life. Isn't that interesting? If you were with us on Sunday on Proverbs 31, remember Solomon's mother, probably Solomon's mother, we're not 100% sure that's who Lemuel was of Proverbs 31, but it's probable. She warned Solomon, she said, Solomon, it is not for kings or princes to be given to wine or strong drink. Remember that? We saw that on Sunday. And now Solomon's telling in his old years, he's now an old man, he says, okay, I tried laughter, that didn't work, and now I tried wine. And notice what he says about this, about the wine, verse 3. I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom and to lay hold on folly. In other words, he knew that it was foolishness. He knew that wisdom, how did he know that wisdom was to not give himself to wine? Because his mom taught him that when he was young. His mom said, it's not for kings or princes. This is foolishness to be giving yourself to wine. But knowing good, right, and well, that Solomon knowing in his brain and knowing in his heart, wisdom said, don't go there. He said, even though I knew I was taking hold of folly, I went there anyway. You know what's spooky about that? Is we do that. All of us do that. We know that we're about to grab something foolish. And yet we grab it anyway. We do it anyway. It's like we're magically drawn to foolishness. Mesmerized, dazed in our eyes, going, I want to sin. And I want to do that sin, and I really want it now. And we know in our heart, oh, it's going to hurt. It's going to kill you. It's going to wipe you out. But you do it anyway. Solomon's saying something here that I think we can all relate to. The guy that's surfing the net and suddenly he's just kind of has a temptation and he knows that it's foolishness and it's folly to start looking at images that are pornographic and sinful and wrong. He knows that it could wipe out his marriage. He knows that he could even lose his job, or he knows that his kids might find out and think that he's a pervert. And yet, even though he knows the folly and the foolishness, he still grabs it and goes for it. That's just one example of thousands of things we can all think of that we all are have tendencies to do. Oh, I just want to take hold of that. I know it's a foolish thing. Solomon's, he knows exactly what he's doing, but he takes it anyway. How sad is that? And so, verse 4, I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. He was a pirate. Did you guys know that? I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got me servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. I also had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasures of kings and of the provinces. I got me men singers and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men as musical instruments, and that of all sorts. So I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion of all my labor. It would do us well as a church to consider and maybe even meditate on the things Solomon lists here, because maybe you and I as Portlanders haven't been able to try all these things that Solomon tried. Maybe you've not tried laughing your head off, or drinking your head off, or building huge fancy houses, or planting wonderful farms, beautiful vineyards, or gardens and trees and fruit, having luscious food and vegetables, making pools of water, irrigation that feeds us trees, having slaves, servants, having 700 wives, 300 concubines. All of these things. See, the chances are there's one thing in your mind, if you're like most of us, you think, if I just had that, then I'd truly be happy. And there's a funny thing. Solomon, he's a slow learner. Man, I hope it doesn't take us that long. See, the problem is, as much as I preach this, talk about this, as much as Solomon tries to warn us, there's still going to be singles in this room, singles in our church who think, yeah, Brad, I understand all that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I just want a man. I just need to be married. I need a husband. Or the guy saying, man, I just need a woman. And man, all you can think about is, oh, why am I still single? And there are those who think, oh, if I was just married, then I'd be happy. And all the married people are going, huh? It's true when Paul says that all that are married will have trouble. It's not easy being married. Oh, there's benefit and blessing, and marriage is great. It's invented by God. Don't get me wrong. But marriage, as it relates to just marriage under the sun, apart from God, in fact, marriage apart from God, in my mind, would be about the worst thing you could ever do. If I were not a Christian, why in the world would I ever get married? I don't understand why the world, people who are not Christians, get married. That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. Marriage is a godly institution that God blesses. And apart from that, it's a worldly tradition that has no benefit or blessing. It just amazes me why someone would tie themselves to one person their whole life. Apart from God. Now, the reason I say that is because with God, marriage is awesome. It's great. And the Lord blesses marriages, and I'm one of those guys, as I mentioned on Sunday, I'm really blessed in marriage. But both Debbie and I are honest with each other. We also know that I'm not her answer, and she's not my answer. But see, we as a wife and a husband understand Jesus is the answer. And because of that, we find great fulfillment in marriage, but we know it's not the whole thing. And so when Debbie and I see these singles running around, oh, all I need is to be married. It just kills me. You know, I've watched this for a lot of years, you know. There's the single guy, kind of, oh man, I just wish I had a wife. There's the married guy, oh man, I'm here at church with my wife and kids and child seats and minivan. And what the single guy sees is this guy standing with his beautiful wife, and man, just a tear starts to flow as he's, oh, there's a couple in love. But the married guy standing there with a bead of sweat rolling down his forehead. Why? Well, he's carrying the car seat, and he's watching the single guy. And what's going on with the single guy? Well, him and all the cool singles of our church, and girls included, they're all singles, and they're saying, hey, where are we going after church? Hey, let's go do something fun. And pew, out they go, whoo! And the single guy, a tear is flowing, or the married guy, tear is flowing. What are we going to do after church, honey? Well, you want to go to lunch? Okay, well, did you get the diaper bag? Diaper bag? Well, the singles are going to Applebee's. Let's go to Applebee's. And so you go in with the diaper bag and the car seats and the screaming babies, and everybody's looking at you in Applebee's like you're demon possessed or something. You see, the thing is, it's like the old story. You know, there's two teardrops flowing down the river. One teardrop was floating along and said, well, who did you belong to? Oh, I was... belong to the person who was single. Who did you belong to? Oh, I belonged to the person who was married. They were both sad. Why? Because they were trying to find fulfillment and contentment and happiness in the condition that they were in, or, you know, the grass is greener on the other side, that the condition they were in wasn't good enough. So they were hoping that they could be like someone else or be in someone else's shoes. And Solomon, one thing after another, singleness, marriage. Did he try marriage? 700 times. Thick. Solomon was one thick dude. And then after he thought, okay, marriage didn't work after 700 times, maybe it's all about having a harem who I'm not married to, just girls that I'm not married to. So he gets 300 of those concubines. Man, and then he tries laughter, and then he tries this and that and the other thing. Houses, farms, cattle, music. Some of you musicians, oh, if I could just be at what's the place there in New York, Square Gardens? Madison? Yeah, whatever. The thing is, your big goal, there you are in your bedroom with your Marshall amp stack, but in your mind, you're before thousands. If I could just be in a band, if I could go big and be famous, then I'd be happy. Oh man, I know guys in big famous bands. And it's brutal. It's totally brutal. Oh, being on stage for the hour and a half is great and everything, but have you seen what they have to do all the rest of the time? I mean, I've been able to travel with Cutlass. You know, they play all the time, all over America. They got a really nice tour bus, and when I first saw it, I thought, ooh, this is nice. But then I was in there for more than 10 minutes, and I started to feel claustrophobic. Because there's like 10, 15 guys living on that bus. And their little bunks, well, I didn't quite fit in them. And man, you know, these guys in Cutlass, you know, we were down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and they set up from like, you know, noon till 7 o'clock when the gig starts. Screaming kids, piles of sweaty people played and just sang and shared the gospel. And yeah, this is what it's all about. Then they have to tear down all that stuff after signing tons of autographs. You're thinking, that sounds great. All the musicians are going, yes, that's what it's about. But then after signing autographs, they're helping haul all the stuff, putting it back in the semis. Then they're cramming onto some stinky, you know, big bus. It's got the bunks and it's nice. There's TVs and stereos. It's nice. But man, then they go in there and they sleep while the bus is bouncing around. They're traveling 10 hours to the next show on the bus and they're sleeping. And they're sleeping while the bus is going around as long as the bus doesn't break down or something. And then they get up at noon the next day because they've been up till 2 a.m. tearing up their gear and doing all that stuff. And you know, that would get real old after about the second show, I think. But there's so many young kids. Oh, if I could just do that. You know, it's an amazing thing how we always think these things will bring satisfaction, but they don't. They really don't. He tries musical instruments, women singers, men singers, but the more he increased, the more he felt bad. In fact, look at verse 11. I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, on the labor that I labored to do. And behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. By the way, this idea of vexation of spirit, the idea is chasing the wind. Chasing the wind. Have you ever tried to chase the wind? How fruitful is that? And that's his point. He's saying all that stuff was like chasing the wind. Verse 12, I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. For what can a man do that cometh after the king? In other words, what guy can do more than a king who's got it all? Even that which have been already done. Verse 13, then I saw that wisdom excelleth folly as far as light excelleth darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. Now you might be saying, okay, Brett, he's getting somewhere. Wisdom versus foolishness, kind of like the Proverbs. He's starting to get it, right? Oh, wait, listen what he says. Verse 15, then I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, so it happens even to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart that this is also vanity, for there is no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever. Seeing that which is now in the days to come shall be forgotten, and how dieth the wise man? As the fool. You see, Solomon, he starts to say, yeah, foolishness, wisdom, there's some benefit there. And you're going, okay, come on, here we go, we're getting close. But he says, but the wise guy dies just like the foolish guy. You know, a lot of Hollywood, a lot of these movie stars and stuff, there's just foolishness there. And the wise man, the person who's walking with the Lord or even doing well, a guy could come and almost start thinking, man, here I am walking with the Lord and doing all the Christian stuff, but I'm going to die just like Ashton Kutcher's going to die, just like all these famous people who I like are going to die. What's the difference? You see, if you have this under the sun mentality, only things that relate to worldliness, man, it's depressing. That's what Solomon's saying. Verse 17. Therefore, I hated life because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous to me. For all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. All my work's just going to be inherited by somebody. And who knoweth whether he shall be wise or a fool, yet shall he have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. In other words, all the stuff I leave behind is just going to go to vanity. It's all vanity. Therefore, I went about, verse 20, to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom and in knowledge and in equity, yet to a man that hath not labored, therein shall he leave it for his portion. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what hath a man of all his labor and of the vexation of his heart, wherein he hath labored under the sun? For all his days are sorrows and his travail grief. Yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw that it was from the hand of God, for who can eat, who else can hasten there hereunto more than I? For God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he giveth travail to gather and to heap up, that he may give to him that is good before God. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. Wait a minute. Solomon, hold on, buddy. You're almost saying the truth. You're talking about God and godliness, and oh, you're starting to move out from under the sun and into the greatness of God. But the problem is he's not quite there yet. He'll get there by the end of this book. But he's still saying, oh man, everything is vanity. Listen, before we pack it in tonight, before we call it an evening, would you tune in here just for a few minutes more? I believe that Solomon is in a condition that we might say, well, that's not us. We're Christians. We're here at church. We're here on a Wednesday night Bible study. We're doing what we're supposed to do, and we already know the answer. And Solomon, well, he's just kind of being long-winded, really. But you have to understand, I believe Solomon, he has been here where we are right here tonight, and he's done this by this time in his life, but somehow even that became vanity to him. You know, I think that it's an important thing for us as Christians to understand, you and I, if we're not careful, you can get saved, you can be confessing your sins, and you can be going through all the motions of Christianity and saying, man, I'm a Christian, I'm going to church, and you know all this stuff, and I'm not even saying you're going to hell. Maybe. I don't know. But even if you're headed for heaven, thing is, I think sometimes if we have the wrong thinking, if we forget that it's not about here and now, it's not about the things that are under the sun, we too can fall into this trap and this way of thinking that Solomon falls into, and that is that it's all vain. Why should I even try anymore? What does it matter if I witness to those people or pray about that or this? Because it never matters anyway. And there are Christians that I've known who were on fire at one point in their life, but because they kind of started feeling the same depression that Solomon's feeling, that it's all vain. It doesn't really mean anything. And pretty soon, they're just hoping that they really do make it in heaven, but that's really all they really have to think about. And I believe that's not the right way to live. You see, I don't mean to give the punchline away. I don't mean to give the answer prematurely, because Solomon's going to have us wallow a bit more. But before we wallow next week, I want to tell you, this is a good chance for us to stop and say, Lord, am I just going through motions? Am I going through some religious routine? Am I doing what I do and saying, oh yeah, I'm a Christian and I'm going to heaven, it's all about Jesus, but it really kind of isn't? Man, that's a dangerous place to be, because even you might find yourself saying, boy, this really isn't. See, I know people that were saved and on fire and touched by the Lord, but at some point in their walk, it became so dry and it became so boring to them, the whole Christian thing. They thought, you know, Christianity really doesn't work. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. That's wrong thinking. You're being like Solomon. It's not that Christianity doesn't work. It's just that you're not enjoying being a Christian and what God wants for you as a Christian. You see, Jesus dealt with this, and I'll give you this just as kind of in closing. John chapter 4, when Jesus met the woman at the well, she was going to get some water. And Jesus deals with this in John chapter 4, verse 13, when he says to her, whosoever drinketh of this water, the well here, the water, literal water, you're going to thirst again. But whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst, but the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. Man, that's what Jesus wants to do. He wants to be your total satisfaction. But as soon as we lose sight that it's all about Jesus and that personal relationship with Him, it's not just going through the motions of church or doing your dutiful devotions in the morning or, you know, witnessing because somebody's there and they have a pulse. It's not what it's about. It's about just knowing Jesus Christ, being in love with Jesus Christ, a personal relationship, because as you drink of that water, you will not be thirsty. You'll be perfectly satisfied. And oftentimes we older Christians, like if you're like me, I've been saved 35 years, I'll tell you something. I've been through times in my life where I saw a new believer running around all excited about Jesus. I'm like, yeah, there's a new believer, young Christian, on fire, but just wait. And then the Lord would correct my heart and I'd realize I'm falling in the way of Solomon. I need to have that zeal and that fire and that joy that the new believer has. It's there for the taking, even if you're an old, crusty Christian. It's there for you. The problem is, we just get in our routine and we lose our joy and we forget that it's not about here and now and us having fun and church being entertaining or anything like that. It's not about any of that. It's about heaven. It's about the bigger picture. It's not about that which is under the sun. So many of us as Christians, we get into the, what's going on in our church, in my garage, in my house, in my career, and it's all the under the sun stuff, and we try to find our joy and fulfillment when we forgot that really, all we need really is just Jesus. It's just Jesus. And Solomon's going to have to learn this, and I believe Solomon will, at the very tiny end of his life, he's going to get it. And I do believe we're going to see Solomon in heaven personally. But man, he's going to have to go through more of this wallowing in his despair before we get to the answer. So you can read ahead for next week, but may the Lord give you a heart to consider and ponder. Lord, am I getting kind of crusty as a Christian? Starting to look to other things for satisfaction and fulfillment because it's not to be found there. We know it to be true, and yet as fools, we go for folly. And we think, oh, that'll make me happy, but it really won't. Is it okay to have a boat, a motorcycle, a big house? I think it is. But it is in relation to what does it matter for the kingdom of God? How are you using it for God's glory? Are you using it thinking it will make you happy? Are you going for that hobby because, well, I just need a break? Or are you going for those things saying, how can I glorify God in this endeavor, in this action, in this job, in this hobby or whatever? How do I bring Jesus Christ into these things? And that's where you find fulfillment. That's where you find joy.